Well, hey, friend, welcome to Job with Julie, hosted by me, Julie Slattery. This podcast is supported by the Ministry Authentic Intimacy, which helps people make sense of God and sexuality. Well, I think it goes without saying that transgenderism and gender dysphoria are no longer hot new topics. Male, female, and men and women are now contested terms, and parents, unfortunately, are encouraged by teachers, doctors, and counselors just to accept the use of puberty blockers and gender-affirming treatments for children and teens who might be struggling with gender dysphoria. You know, when the stakes are as high as they are with something like this, it's really important for all of us to understand what's happening and to know exactly what has been informing the advice we receive from the medical and counseling community. Well, that's where we're headed in my conversation with Dr. Miriam Grossman today. Dr. Grossman is a child psychiatrist who has testified before Congress about why the push to affirm and accept transitions is so problematic for children and why it's likely to have devastating effects. Dr. Grossman has also written a book called Lost in Trans Nation, which is an eye-opening and very informative resource about this issue. She is fiercely advocate based on her work with children and adolescents, as she advocates for hurting children and for parents who are navigating this difficult topic. She brings light to a lot of the challenges that these children and families are facing. So this is one of those conversations you're going to want to grab your coffee, maybe even listen twice, and just soak in the information that you're going to be hearing from Dr. Miriam Grossman today. Dr. Grossman, thank you for taking the time to share with me and our audience. I have so been looking forward to this conversation because I've learned so much about you. And this topic of transgender, particularly with our children, is one that everybody is aware of, but I don't think anybody knows where to go to for true information and real help. And you provide that.
Well, thank you, Julie. And thank you so much for having me today. I've been looking forward to this as well.
Well, your specialty is really in this area now. Like, you have become known as an advocate for children, an advocate for parents and families, pushing against this movement that is so quickly just accepting gender ideology. I'm sure to your demise, like professionally and personally, this isn't an easy thing to stand against in our culture. What is it that got you interested in this field in the first place?
Well, I'll tell you how it happened. And I explain more of this in my recent book, Lost in Trans Nation. The way that I got into this, I'm a, as you said, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And some years ago, I was working at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. And I was a psychiatrist for students there. So undergrads, graduate students, but by and large, young people in their late teens, early to mid-20s. And I realized that, or I should say I discovered, that a large percentage of my patients had sexually transmitted infections. Mm-hmm. They had the human papillomavirus, herpes. Some of them had had chlamydia. Many of them were very concerned about having HIV. Many of them had had one or more abortions. And I became alarmed and wanted to learn, what are these young people being told about their sexual health and how to protect their sexual health? So I took a deep dive into the sex education in this country and discovered that sex education is, I would say, not about maintaining health and about preventing disease. It's about sexual freedom. Mm-hmm. It's about teaching young people that they are sexual creatures from cradle to grave, and that they have the right at any time to act on their sexual impulses and to explore and to experiment, et cetera, et cetera. And this was extremely alarming, Julie, because as I'm sure you're aware, the younger a person is, especially a girl, when she becomes sexually active, the more likely she is to get a sexually transmitted infection. And that infection may be a virus that could be with her indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't really have cures for these viruses. So anyway, I realize you asked me about transgenderism. So as I was exploring and learning more and more about our sex education, I kind of stumbled across what kids were being told about being boys or girls. And they were being told, now this is back in the 2000s when I was looking into this, they were being told that there's something called gender. Gender is separate from your biology, from the physical reality of your body. Gender is like a psychological sex, and gender represents who you truly are.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that there are times when a person's gender does not match their sex, their biology, and that is a normal variant. And in those cases, those people can pursue medical interventions to bring their physical bodies in line with their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So when I read that, I mean, that was a real eye opener.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, what are we doing here? First of all, there is no medical basis for this idea. What there is a scientific basis for is the fact that male and female are established at conception.
Mm-hmm.
And that the moment that the egg and the sperm unite, that creates an individual, an embryo that grows into a fetus, that grows into a child, that is either male or female.
Mm-hmm.
Sex is not assigned at birth. That only would refer to perhaps the 0.02% of babies, a very, very small percentage of babies that are born who, for a medical reason, have what we call ambiguous genitalia. They're not clearly male or female. And in those cases, sometimes a sex is quote unquote assigned. But in the vast, in almost every case, sex is well established and it is simply recognized at birth, if not before.
Mm-hmm. Now, the things that you're describing are common knowledge to us now with this belief that gender and biological sex are two different things. But when you first were discovering that this is what kids were being taught, how long ago was that?
Okay, so I was doing this research in 2007, 2008,
mm-hmm.
and then I wrote a book. It actually recently came out in paperback, not about the transgenderism, but I wrote a book called You're Teaching My Child What?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that was a book about sex education and the inaccuracies, misinformation, and basically the ideology of sex education, which is dangerous to young people.
Mm-hmm.
So in the midst of doing all that research on STDs and condoms and so on, a lot of which, by the way, involved Planned Parenthood, because Planned Parenthood is one of our, if not the, one of the flagship organizations federally funded to provide curricula to young people on sex education, sexuality education.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of that book, You're Teaching My Child What, is indicting what Planned Parenthood and other organizations were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was doing this research in 2007, 2008, I discovered this transgender ideology that was being, our kids were being indoctrinated even so many years ago with this misinformation and with this ideology. It's more similar, really, Julie, to a religion than to any sort of medicine or science. It's based on beliefs
mm-hmm.
that cannot be substantiated, cannot be proven scientifically.
Yeah. Let me mention your book that recently came out, Lost in Translation, which is an excellent resource. It's so well done. In that book, you document the lack of research that supports what our doctors are saying, what our clinicians are saying, what our educators are saying. I think most people don't know that. They assume that the medical community and the psychiatric community like discovered something that the rest of us didn't know. And there's all this research behind kind of the standard of care today. How did we get here if it's not research-based?
Okay, you're exactly right. And the parents who come to me with their children who are in distress about being a boy or a girl almost uniformly say to me that they were just sideswiped by all this. They didn't expect it. Mm-hmm. They didn't expect this announcement from their child who had never been uncomfortable with being a boy or a girl in general. And when it did happen, and they went and did some research and perhaps went to their pediatrician or they consulted with a gender clinician, they were led to believe that on this issue, there is basically a medical consensus. And the medical consensus is that you must honor your child's declaration, that you must go along with your child's request to consider them no longer your daughter or your son, but mm-hmm. the opposite or something else. Mm-hmm. You must use a new name, new pronouns, etc., etc. And you're right, Julie, that most parents believe, you see, we trust our doctors. We trust our therapists. Yeah. We would be inclined to trust the teachers at school, the school principals, our guidance counselors, social workers who work in schools. Of course, that's the ideal. But sadly, and this is one of the reasons that I wrote the book, on this particular issue, Julie, we can no longer trust those people necessarily mm-hmm. because they are following the, well, first of all, they may be activists in their own right. Okay, so as much as we want to trust the people at our kids' schools, as well as our pediatrician, our therapist, we have to be vigilant and we have to understand that there are activists among them who have certain beliefs. They are not based in science. They are not based in medicine. And they are going to promote those beliefs to your child. Now, in addition, there are those well-meaning professionals who are simply misinformed because they have automatically trusted their professional organization. So let me speak specifically now about the American Academy of Pediatrics. Okay. Now, if you take your child to the pediatrician after your child has expressed some gender confusion or perhaps has asked you to use a new name, and you sit down with your pediatrician and ask advice, chances are that that pediatrician, you know, doctors are very busy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, everyone's really busy, but doctors are really, really busy. Mm-hmm. And we cannot take the time that it would take to fully explore every subject that we need to be informed about. So what do? We go to our professional organization, we go to their journals, their website, their meetings, and we're going to basically adopt and trust what they tell us to do. Now, the American Association of Pediatricians, and most people are not aware of this, has been long ago captured by a radical leftist agenda. Mm-hmm. And part of that agenda is the transgender ideology. And so the American Academy of Pediatrics has come out with guidelines and policy statements that just basically say, put your child in the driver's seat. It doesn't matter if your child may be depressed or anxious or have a history of trauma or be on the autism spectrum. Your child knows who she or he is, and we have to honor that Otherwise, your child is at risk for self-harm and suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Julie, you know very well, as does your audience, I'm sure, that parents will do just about anything right. to save the life of their child.
Yeah. And we don't know. I mean, as parents, if whether it be something physical like ongoing headaches or be something psychological like depression or this question of gender, the average parent doesn't know what to do other than let me bring my child to an expert. And our assumption is that our experts have done the research. They know what's best for our kids. So what you're saying is it's very disconcerting to think my kid's doctor, whatever counselor I might go to, is actually going to give me advice that's harmful. Like, how did we get here? Because my assumption would be as you went through medical school and your residency and you learned all this, you learned to make clinical decisions based on outcomes. But that's not true with this?
Well, it's not true with this. Correct. I'll explain that. But basically what I'm saying, and people, you know, will realize that when they read or listen to the book. So what people will realize very soon within the first few pages of my book is that I am telling parents to trust their gut. They know their child best. And if they run into a professional, either a guidance counselor, a pediatrician, or a therapist, that is telling them to put their child in the driver's seat and to just rubber stamp this self-diagnosis, turn the other way and run. That's what I'm saying. Run. And I explain how parents can find therapists who are not going to do that. Therapists that are going to be based in the science and the medicine and are going to help the child and the family get through this crisis.
Yeah.
Instead of just rubber stamp it. So how did we get here? Well, you know, I do have a few chapters on that, but, you know, just to summarize, what happened, Julie, is that in our previously trusted professional organizations, and I'm going to include here not only medical, but also educational. So the professional organizations of school guidance counselors, school principals, the teachers union, they have all been overtaken by a small but very vocal and aggressive group of radicals who foist this agenda on the group and then publish guidelines and policy statements as if there's some sort of a consensus, as if, you know, they did a referendum of all the teachers in the country and all the principals in the country, all the pediatricians and child psychiatrists. There has never been such a referendum. And I will tell you that the American Psychiatric Association a few months ago published the most, I would call it a gender manifesto. It is an over-the-top, radical, ideology-packed textbook. They're calling it a textbook that is meant to be used by mental health professionals in training. Now, this is very, very alarming. You know, it's the whole intersectional Marxist ideology, and they use that to make their argument for transgenderism. What I'm saying is that we have gathered over 3,500 signatures in our letter to the American Psychiatric Association objecting to the publication of this highly politicized gender manifesto. I'd like your audience to sign it. But I'm bringing it up because I want people, especially parents, to be aware that there is a debate that is raging over this issue, and that when they're led to believe by therapists and teachers and by government officials, elected officials, and appointed officials who stand up and say that there's a medical consensus, that is not correct. What there is a debate. And
yeah,
it's a very dangerous situation.
Yeah. And I don't even feel like it's a debate, Dr. Grossman. Like, as a clinical psychologist, I feel like the APA says if you don't go by the gender ideology, you're unethical. You could get reported. You could get your license revoked. So to me, it doesn't even feel like, hey, this gender situation, particularly with our young adolescents, is a big deal. Let's look at different ways that we can approach treatment. It's like, this is the way. And if you don't, and I'm sure you feel that way in the medical community as well, there's no option.
Well, that's correct. They're basically, and you know, I write about this in the book, how people, physicians, pediatricians, endocrinologists have tried to speak up in their professional organizations. They've tried to get things published, letters to the editor. They've tried to arrange panel discussions in the annual meetings of their societies, and they simply are not given the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So it's a tyranny. Mm-hmm. Okay. And when I say that it's a debate, I mean that there's a debate on what should we do for these kids? What exactly should we be doing with these families?
Yeah.
And we here in the United States are outliers. It's important for parents to understand that countries, LGBT-friendly, progressive countries such as Sweden, Norway, Finland, and the United Kingdom have taken a close look at this issue, and they've examined the data just in the past few years, and they have done a 180, meaning that they have, instead of going in the, you know, providing quote unquote affirming care with medicalization of minors, they have looked at the data, and the data show that there is a significant risk of harm, mm-hmm. but there is no evidence of long-term benefit. And mm-hmm. therefore, we cannot be doing this to our youth. What we need to be doing for them is giving them psychotherapy. So in this country, we are outliers, because mm-hmm. what we are saying here with gender affirming care, like I said, put the child in the driver's seat. If an 11-year-old comes and says, I don't want to go through puberty, it makes me very nervous. I don't want to get my period. I don't want to grow facial hair. Then you're supposed to go ahead and give them powerful puberty blockers, the effect of which, by the way, we have no idea down the line, 5, 10, 20 years later, what those puberty blockers are going to do to these kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would even say, if we go upstream, thing that makes me even more angry is our media, our social media, our educational ideology is actually encouraging gender confusion. So it's not just that they're showing up in a doctor's office or a therapist's office and saying, hey, help us. But we're creating even the question that
correct.
Your body may correct. Tell you you're a female, but that doesn't necessarily mean
that's a very important point. And I would go further, Julie, I would say that the culture and the material coming out of almost anywhere you turn celebrates confusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It celebrates confusion. And this, we're talking about confusion about something that is at the core of our humanity.
Yeah.
At the core of being human is being either male or female. Mm-hmm. And we are indoctrinating, we are introducing to the youngest of children. I mean, there are board books for kids that can't read yet, may not be able to even talk yet, mm-hmm. that say things like, you know, when you were born, you were unable to tell the adults how you felt. And so the adults took one guess about whether you were a boy or a girl. Maybe they were right. Maybe they were wrong. These are books that are for the youngest wow. of kids.
Right. And I feel like some of this thinking came out of maybe the well intention of serving a very small percentage of the population that had that what we might call gender dysphoria starting in young ages, or intersex individuals. And that still is an issue. That's a population that needs to be served. But what we're talking about here is the introduction to all children, the idea that gender is in the mind, it's not in the body.
Correct. I'm so happy you're bringing that up. You know, when you look at the population, there's been, you know, such an explosion, a tsunami of kids who are confused about being a boy or a girl. We have a 5,000% increase in the past 8 or 10 years of these kids. It used to be something extraordinarily rare. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about physically healthy children, mm-hmm. not children who have any sort of medical abnormality. They are physically healthy. And yet these activists are aggressively coming in and introducing the idea that it's normal to reject your body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that it's even, like I said, something to celebrate mm-hmm. when you do reject your body, when you want and dream of having a different body, a body that has had, you know, healthy organs removed.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a healthy thing.
No. And it's preying on the most vulnerable. Like I remember what it felt like to be a 10 or 11 year old girl and how insecure you are in general and how you're searching for identity, how you fear rejection. And boy, to introduce even more insecurity. Hey friend, if this conversation is resonating with you, then I think you're gonna like exploring more of our resources on sexuality and culture. Last month, I had an interview with John and Sarah Stone Street about gender. I also interviewed Pastor Chase Rapagel about masculinity, and those are just two recent Java episodes, but we have a whole page on our Authentic Intimacy website that's just dedicated to resources on topics around sexuality and culture, and it's a great place to explore podcast episodes, blog posts, and Q&A videos on understanding kind of where the culture is impacting sexuality. We have content on everything from the impact of purity culture to addressing abuse within the church. We've linked to that page in our show notes, along with links to the two episodes I mentioned. So make sure you go ahead and check those out. All right, back to my conversation with Dr. Miriam Grossman. I'd love for you to speak to the rates of anxiety, depression, suicidality, and even other underlying conditions like autism that often go along with some of these trans questions and struggles. Because again, I think most parents aren't aware that a lot of times they're going together.
Yes. Very important point. The research that we have indicates that a majority of kids do have what we call comorbid conditions, meaning emotional disorders or neuropsychiatric conditions mm-hmm. like autism or ADHD that accompany the development of this unhappiness with their bodies. And you see, what happens is that these kids may have, many of them, a very hard time fitting in socially. You know that kids who are on the autism spectrum have a particularly difficult time, you know, fitting in with peers, especially, you know, middle school, high school. Everyone wants to have a group that they fit in with. And a lot of these kids never find it. Mm-hmm. And the way that they end up finding it, Julie, is when they declare themselves to be a sexual minority, either LGB or T.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they declare that, they are love bombed. Mm-hmm. Okay. They come into school, they say, I'm not identifying anymore as, you know, as I'm not Patty, I'm Patrick. My pronouns are they, them, and they are love bombed. Mm-hmm. And they believe that they have found their group in which they fit in.
Mm-hmm.
So parents have to be aware that if their child is suffering And they may not know that their child is on the autism spectrum. It's important to be aware that a lot of these kind of quirky, really, some of them really, really smart kids that are just a little bit different. They think differently. They sometimes are very brilliant, very high achieving, but they don't quite fit in with the mainstream groups. And those kids are going to be at risk for this ideology. There's there's a whole bunch of reasons why kids on the autism spectrum are at risk. And one of them is that they display what we call black and white thinking. Yeah. So they have difficulty grasping that most of life is not black and white. Most of life is in the gray. Mm-hmm. And what they do is, for example, a girl who might be feel that she doesn't fit in with the other girls. She's not, you know, into the stereotypical female makeup and clothes and all those ridiculous. You see, this gender ideology, part of why I hate it so much is it forces us into those gender stereotypes, mm-hmm. which, I mean, I'm from the generation in which we were just fighting those gender to destroy those gender stereotypes, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. Girls, you know, belong in the kitchen. Girls, you know, love makeup and clothes and gossiping. I mean, those were, you know, boys like sports, boys mm-hmm. like math and computers and all those ridiculous things that we now know are simply untrue. Mm-hmm. So a girl, though, who's on the spectrum and who, you know, goes to school day in and day out, and feels that she doesn't fit in with the rest of the girls who are now, you know, talking about their romantic crushes and they're, you know, into makeup and clothes and looking sexy. She may feel like, oh, well, if I don't fit in with them, maybe I'm a boy.
Yeah.
It's black and white thinking. Mm-hmm. So instead of understanding, and this is where the parents come in, that mm. there's many different ways of being a girl.
Yes.
And there's many different ways of being a boy. And just because you don't fit in with the stereotypes and perhaps you don't fit in with most of the kids at school does not mean, don't let anyone ever tell you that that means you're not a boy or a girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's so essential that not only we understand kind of some of those stereotypes that feed into this, but as you mentioned, the comorbidity of neurodiversity, but also depression, anxiety, suicidality. And why this is so important is because some parents will just dismiss the question of the gender confusion, but not realize that there's something deeper going on. Like your kid needs help. It's just not the help you think.
But you know what, Julie? You see what happens, the gender experts, quote unquote, if you bring such a child to them, they're going to say, all these other issues, the depression, the anxiety, is because they are really transgender.
Yes.
And if they are given the chance, if they are completely affirmed and put in the driver's seat and allowed to live as the opposite sex and have their puberty stopped and given cross-sex hormones and then later surgeries sometimes, they're going to be much better. They're not going to be anxious. They're not going to mm-hmm. be depressed. They're not going to be suicidal. And we simply don't have the data. The data shows us actually that they may become worse. Their mental health is often worse after these treatments.
Right, right. So I'd love to walk through these steps that a physician or a gender specialist might take a kid through. The first one is sort of a social transition, which is the change of the name and the pronouns, allowing a girl to dress like a boy, get a boyish haircut, or the other way around. And some parents and therapists would say, hey, this is a very non-invasive intervention. You're not introducing medicine or surgeries. And if it alleviates a kid's anxiety and gender dysphoria, like, go for it. Whereas other people would say, no, actually, that's a gateway. Like, as soon as you start to transition socially, you're opening up the road that doesn't stop. So from your clinical experience and research, where do you fall on that?
Well, I would start by saying that, you know, every kid and family is unique. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to give like sort of a cookbook, you know, type of response here, but I am comfortable saying that when we quote unquote socially transition a child, it is putting them on a path on which they are headed toward medicalization, mm-hmm. and they are less likely to turn around.
Yeah.
They're less likely. They're much more likely to continue with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's important to mention, there's a lot to say here, Julie. I want your audience to understand that we have research over the decades on children who had severe gender dysphoria from an early age. And they were followed over time. And it was discovered that once they reach early adulthood, after going through a natural organic puberty, that between something like 65 and 98% of them got over their gender dysphoria.
Mm-hmm.
So a good percentage of both the boys and the girls, these were mostly boys, because you see, the population of kids who, these are going to be like the Jazz Jennings of the world, mm. who come to their parents when they're 2, 3, 4 years old. And at that young age, they already have this, it's a very, very rare condition, but they have a discomfort with being a boy or a girl. So I'm talking now about those kids, because those are the kids that we have the most research on. Our current group of kids are new.
Right. So we have longitudinal studies on them.
Well, we're just starting to collect that data. Mm-hmm. But our new current group of kids are mostly girls, and are mostly girls who develop their gender distress in adolescence. So it is a completely different population. But just getting back to that first group, they, when permitted to go through normal adolescence, and of course, they may have been allowed to wear in androgynous clothing. They may have been allowed to maybe have a nickname instead of their birth name. You know, there were different ways of managing it. But the bottom line is that they got through this dysphoria. There's something evidently that happens during puberty that helps these young people to resolve their distress.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be a big surprise, because what's puberty? Puberty is an essential period of normal development in which every organ system, including the brain, matures and becomes adult. And so the brain matures, and the brain during puberty is exposed to high levels of either estrogen or testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense that there would be these vast changes within the brain, within a person's self-perception, a person's self-understanding, identity. They go through a little bit more life. Perhaps they experience their first romantic relationship. And for whatever reason, and I've seen this in my own practice, they end up saying, you know what? I'm actually okay. I don't need to have my breasts removed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. I'm okay with this. You know, I may want to use a nickname, or I may want to, you know, I'm not going to go out there and wear tank tops and a push-up bra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to dress more, you know, on the quote unquote masculine, if you want to call it that. It's ridiculous, but you know what I'm saying? When they're allowed to go through their puberties, they do get over it.
Yeah. And they figure out a way to be female or male the way that feels comfortable for them.
I think
the research says, was it about 80% of those kids that had gender dysphoria younger, like about 80% of them by early adulthood have resolved it? Is that correct?
Well, it depends. We have 11 studies. Mm-hmm. And so the results range from, I think it's something like 65 to 98%. So okay. 80% would be, yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. I guess you could say on the average.
Okay.
So it's really a vast majority.
Yeah.
So that's something that you need to keep in mind. You see, when we give kids puberty blockers, mm-hmm. we are taking away from them the chance, the opportunity to actually have this condition resolve in a natural manner.
Yes.
Now, is the child going to be happy that they have to go through puberty? No, they may freak out.
Yeah, and hey, I freaked out and I didn't have gender dysphoria. So puberty is pretty upsetting for a lot of us.
But you know what? That's why you have parents who are grounded in reality, parents who can reassure the child that many, many people have gone through this before them, mm-hmm. and they can share their own stories about, no one is ecstatic that I know of to get their period, but it's something that once you understand what it is, and it actually indicates that your female body is working the way that it should be, mm-hmm. and that this is normal, and it's not something to be terrified about. These are things that the kid is picking up through their social media and through the internet. Now, what I want to also tell your listeners that I have an appendix in my book written by an IT specialist for parents on precisely how to get control of your child's internet use. Mm-hmm. Believe me, I cannot overemphasize the importance of protecting your child against the groomers and other individuals online who are eager to reach your child.
Yeah.
Even at the age of 8 or 10 or 11 years old, they are eager to reach your child, and they are going to be in chat groups, and they're going to be in all sorts of places that you don't expect them to be when your child is playing games online. Many kids are really heavily into gaming. You have to get control over what your child is being exposed to online.
Mm. Dr. Grossman, another thing that you detail in your book, which was very eye-opening, is the medical impact of a lot of these interventions. As you mentioned, there's not a lot of research on puberty blockers because we've never used them for this purpose before. But also the hormone therapy and eventually the gender reassignment surgeries. I know you can't get into great detail in the time that we have, but could you just give a little bit of information on what we're actually doing to the body and the long-term effects of that?
Yeah. Well, let's just start with the fact that no matter how talented the endocrinologist, no matter how talented the surgeon, they can never change a person's sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they can intervene in ways that will produce a persona, okay, a facsimile, if you want to say, of the opposite sex that can be very convincing. But it is not actually a man cannot become a woman. A woman mm-hmm. cannot become a man. So it's important to point that out, because at the bottom of all this is actually a falsehood. And the kids are being misled that they will become an actual woman. I mean, I remember Jazz, which, I watched that series very closely. And Jazz said so many times, I'm going to have a vagina after this vaginoplasty, and I'm going to be a real woman. Well, on some level, I know that Jazz realizes that Jazz is, I don't use the pronouns, so it's a little cumbersome now, but I'm just going to say Jazz instead mm-hmm. of the pronouns, the mm-hmm. preferred pronouns. I think that as Jazz gets older and more mature and experiences more of life and realizes that all the interventions eliminated the potential of being a biological parent, mm-hmm. eliminated the ability to be have a normal sexual response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are terrible things that are being done to kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, you asked me to talk a little bit about the medical interventions. These interventions are experimental. The data that we have about sex reassignment surgery over the long term, over decades, which again does not apply to the current population. It applies to a population of mostly men who experience gender dysphoria either from childhood or as middle-aged men. The data do not show that they're doing that well. Are there anecdotal, you know, this person or that person is extremely happy with the interventions and is very much at peace now with their lives, whereas before they were not at peace? Of course there are. Mm-hmm. And I'm not ignoring those people and I'm not writing them off. And I am not trying to minimize the distress that gender dysphoria is. I mean, I can't imagine waking up every morning and rejecting my physical reality. I can't mm-hmm. imagine how distressing that must be. However, we have no way of predicting which individuals will feel better after these surgeries and which will feel regret and worse mm-hmm. after these medical interventions.
Yeah.
So in terms of the consequences, if parents sign on the dotted line and they agree for their young child who's just entered puberty to be given puberty blockers, which are in almost every case followed by cross-sex hormones. So in other words, the gender experts are telling the child and the parents that stopping puberty is just going to give you more time to think about this, to figure things out. Well, that's actually not true, because in 99% of cases, these kids, by taking puberty blockers, are squarely placed on the assembly line and go straight to cross-sex hormones,
mm-hmm.
which means that many of them are going to be infertile, permanently infertile.
Wow. Yeah. And to make that decision as a 14 or 15-year-old, and to trust a child's sense of self, like we don't let any 14 or 15-year-old do what they feel like doing, especially if there's these long-term consequences like what you're talking about. It's just...
Look, a lot of people, Julie, these days don't really realize until they're in their early or mid-30s yeah. how much they would like to have a biological child.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, when you even think about a 13-year-old getting a tattoo, you're like, you don't want to do that because you won't like that tattoo 15 years from now. And that's a small choice when you talk about these kinds of medical interventions.
And you know, the doctors are aware that mm-hmm. there really is a problem with informed consent when it mm-hmm. comes to young kids consenting mm-hmm. to interventions that are going to impact their fertility. And mm-hmm. I write about this in my book. You know, there's evidence. It's on YouTube. There's a panel discussion amongst gender doctors in mm-hmm. which the endocrinologist, his name is Metzger, I believe, and he's an endocrinologist that he admits, you know, I don't know what, you know, when we give these puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones to kids and we speak about their infertility with them, and they say, oh, I don't care, I'll just adopt, I don't really care, I don't mm-hmm. want children. He openly admits, like, I don't know, I don't feel so great about doing that. I mean, we mm-hmm. all know that they can't really give this consent. And then he goes ahead, Julie, and he says the most remarkable thing. He says, but we all want to make the kids happy in the moment.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, I don't know if he's a parent or not, but the goal is not to make your child happy in the moment.
That would be bad parenting advice. Yeah. And so a lot of this does then fall on the parents. And I know even though your specialty is children and adolescents, your heart right now is really with these parents who don't know where to turn. They take their child to a doctor or even a hospital because of a suicide attempt, and they are told, if you love your child, you're going to go along with this. And actually, you could be contributing to depression and suicidality if you don't go along with it.
Correct. Correct. And this is the worst kind of emotional manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are told, and I've heard this time and again, if you don't go along with this, you're the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're a transphobe.
Yeah.
You are a bigot. And sometimes the parents are told this in front of their child.
Mm-hmm.
And what this does, Julie, is that on top of the gender confusion, the child is being told, your parents are not good people.
Mm, you can't trust them.
You can't trust them. And, you know, what kids are told by many of the adults, very sadly and very alarmingly, but the adults that are in this gender ideology space, and certainly online and at school, is that kids can be told, your home may not be safe for you.
Yeah.
And I tell the story, multiple stories in my book, of parents being reported to Child Protective Services and children being permanently removed from the parents losing custody of their child. And these are loving, devoted parents, simply because they won't go along with this narrative.
Wow. Oh, it's just, it's horrible.
Well, so exactly. So I have in the book also two appendices for parents written by attorneys on how to deal with schools and how to deal with Child Protective Services. And this is why parents need to read my book or listen to my book before this hits them, before this nuclear bomb hits their family.
Mm-hmm.
So the best time to read it really would be when your child is small.
Mm-hmm.
So you know how to fight the indoctrination and to inoculate your child early on before the activists reach them. Yeah. That's what I want parents to do.
Mm. Can you talk about the trauma that a parent experiences, and maybe siblings even, that a family system experiences when they have a kid that's going through this?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the hardest things, really. I mean, of course, I'm worried about the kids, but honestly, I've seen the destruction that comes as a consequence of these kids being indoctrinated and being turned against their parents. And it's truly, not only is it heartbreaking, but you see, I'm very angry at my profession. I'm angry at the mental health profession for demonizing parents who simply insist on living in reality and insist on, you know, they know that they have a boy or a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they want to help them in every conceivable way, but they draw the line at denying reality. They draw the line at consenting to these medical interventions that, like I've said over and over again, are experimental. And, you know, we don't have the data, the long-term data on the current population of kids who are mostly, not all, but maybe 60% girls, and maybe half of them or more are on the autism spectrum. And they have all sorts of other issues. And the correct response to these kids is, and I have a chapter also in the book on what is the correct response. I have a sample conversation between a parent and child who has announced a new identity, and how the parent can remain supportive, curious, and loving without saying, well, yeah, of course, you know, you're in charge. I accept this. You're not a girl, you're a boy. That's what parents, you know, I caution parents from doing that because then you are placing your child on a dangerous path.
Yeah.
What you want to do is express your love, your support. You want to say, I can see that this is important to you, and therefore it's important to me. Mm-hmm. I may not know so much about this right now, but I am going to become an expert. I am an expert at loving you.
Yeah.
I am an expert at protecting you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that statement is building trust with your kid. You know, like when your kid knows, even if they don't agree with you or they get mad or they're hurt, they know that you're not going to move on something foundational that actually provides more security in the long run. So even though the medical profession would say you're not trustworthy, that's the most trustworthy response.
And you know, Julie, I've dealt with a lot of parents, and I have to tell you that sometimes parents, things get so difficult mm-hmm. that parents have to take what we call a nuclear option, yeah. meaning take your kid out of school, yeah. homeschool, or even mm-hmm. parents sometimes move.
Yeah.
They might move to a different state. They may even mm-hmm. move to a different country.
Yeah.
To simply take their child away from this environment that is bombarding them 24/7 with these false beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't thank you enough for the work that you're doing, Dr. Grossman, and raising an awareness. You know, I think in our mom-to-mom conversations or adult conversations, we'll say things like, this is crazy. How did we get here? But you're walking the road of working with kids and adolescents and families, but also documenting the research. And what a gift to us and to just families who are hurting and confused in the midst of this. And again, I said this at the beginning of our conversation, but I'm sure it hasn't been easy for you. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of pushback. And what has caused you to just persist in it, even though it's been difficult?
Well, you know, I've just seen so much, and I've seen so much suffering, and it's man-made mm-hmm. suffering. It's mm-hmm. not like suffering from schizophrenia mm-hmm. or diabetes or cancer. It's man-made.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something else. I know that your audience is mostly Christian, Catholic, and I would like to just disclose that my faith tells me that there's truth, there's falsehood. We have to stand up for truth.
Yeah.
And when we see something that's wrong going on, we have to stand up and fight it.
Wow, there's just so much to process in this conversation. And honestly, in many ways, we could feel fearful about what's happening in our world as well. But, you know, I want to encourage you. God says that even when we are walking through the valley of the shadow of death, his rod and staff comfort us. And that means any trial we might face. So if you are a parent or a grandparent with a teen or a child who's experiencing gender dysphoria, or maybe a young adult, remember that the first battle you are called to fight is really a spiritual one. It's a heavy thing to have to carry that you're walking through right now. But thankfully, as a follower of Jesus Christ, you are not intended to bear this alone. I'd encourage you to get a copy of Dr. Grossman's book, Lost in Transnation. Now, this book is based on medical information and research. It's not a faith-based book, but it's super helpful. So I'd encourage you to visit the link in our show notes. We've also included a link to the other book she mentioned, You're Teaching My Child What, if you want to take a look at that one as well. Next week is going to be a very different conversation, but still an interesting episode. You're going to hear my interview with Chris and Stephanie Teague. They are the couple behind the duo Out of the Dust. They got married young out of Christian school, and then their marriage took a surprising and unfortunate turn. Make sure you tune in and listen to that. But that's all I have for today. Hey, thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next week on Java with Julie.